There are more than 600 million Chinese women in the world. One out of every 9 people on this planet is a Chinese woman. Who are these women? The images of women in China today are several. Some of us have perhaps read about the lives of women in Amy Tan's The Joy Luck Club, or perhaps cried through the movie a year or two ago. Many of us have seen pictures of women with bound feet from old China, or have read articles about women today dealing with the one child per family policies in new China. Perhaps you visited the People's Republic of China a few years ago, or just watched the evening news a few nights ago and noticed the contrasting images of rural women with bound feet plodding through the rice paddies, while their urban counterparts are swinging their purses, wearing makeup and mini skirts, strolling down the major urban areas. Which one of these women represents the typical Chinese woman? And can we even generalize who these women are? And really, how can we begin to talk about them without knowing where they live in the agricultural areas and conditions under which they live? Let's look at the map for a few minutes. When you look at this map of China, think of China being roughly the same size as the United States. It's just a tad bit larger than the United States. But then you have to think of this area housing 22% of the world's population and feeding them on 7% of the world's arable land. As you can see by looking at China and thinking of it as comparable to the US, yes, we live in a large country, and China is also a large country, but you can see that less than half of it is land that you can really use, and like I said, 7% of the world's arable land. You can look at this whole section. Are the highest mountains in the world. This is where Mount Everest is located. These are the Himalayas, where the average altitude is like being at the summit of Mount Rainier, 14, 15, 16,000 feet. Here you've got the Gobi Desert, you've got high deserts, and then even in South China, where you see the beautiful pictures in National Geographic or in magazines about the rice paddies that are built on the sides of mountains. Yes, they look very beautiful to us and to photographers taking them, but they certainly didn't like carving up those mountains. That was hard work. But here you have land in southern China that is very great for growing products, but is still quite mountainous. So if you look at this map, there are really only 4 well-known agricultural areas of China, again, feeding this huge population, 1.2 billion people, or again, 1/4 to 1/5 of the world's population. So the 4 agricultural areas are northern China, the North China Plain, up near the capital of Beijing, where they do not grow rice, but wheat and other crops like that. And then the Yangtze Delta. The Yangtze River is the longest river in China, the 3rd longest river in the world. It starts in Tibet and cuts through central China out through Shanghai. So this is an important agricultural area. And then, as I mentioned, southern China, the Canton area, are again the areas where you see the rice paddies, where they can grow rice 2 or 3 crops a year. And the 4th area is Sichuan Province, which is called the breadbasket of China. Sichuan is the largest province or most populated province of China. Over 100 million people live here. But as you can see, most of it is mountainous. So this 100 million people live in a very, very small area. The reason I bring up agriculture when I'm talking about women of China is that about 75% of the Chinese women and men live in the rural areas and work at agriculture, at feeding this huge population. Another thing to think about as I say that I'm going to talk about women of China in an hour, you know, again, how can I generalize about them? There are more than 55 different ethnic groups in China. So I showed some pictures of Mongols, some pictures of women from Southwest China in their ethnic clothes. Tibetans are considered part of China politically, so Tibetan women would be considered Chinese women. But in China, there are 55 different ethnic groups, all with different cultures, different languages. And most of those 55 groups live in the border regions, so Mongols or Kazakhs. So you've got Kazakhstan right across the border. Well, you know, in China, you also have the Kazakh people. You have Hui or Muslim groups that are also up in this area. You have the Dai people down here who are right across the border from Thailand. They are ethnically Thai people speaking that language. But one thing to note is that the one major group, Han Chinese, make up 92% of the population. So these other 55 ethnic groups only make up 8% of the population. So what I'm going to be talking about most of the time is really referring a lot to Han women, but still, how can you generalize about Han women? Because those two would be found in this area, the Han people, where they have been for thousands and thousands of years. But if you go from one mountain over to another mountain, you're going to meet Han people, but maybe speaking with a different dialect that you might not be able to understand, with different customs and different ways that they celebrate weddings and other things like that. Just because of this being such a huge country with such a diverse topographical area. So again, you're going to run into that. Again, you know, how can I generalize? In my travels, I've met women in the urban areas who are studying at different universities, who are reading some of the same books that we're reading. At the same time, as I've traveled all over China, I will still meet women who are washing their clothes down by the river over a rock, just as they did centuries ago. So very, very impossible topic. And now I'm going to launch in to 2,500 years of looking at women. Who are these women, as Mao Zedong once said, hold up half the sky? What has their legacy been? And how did their lives change when Mao and the Red Army marched into Beijing in 1949? What are the changes that they're going through today? In order to answer these questions now in 50 minutes or less, I want to describe women in three periods of Chinese history. First, talking about traditional China, then going on to Maoist China, and finally, the Deng Xiaoping era, or the era since Mao died in 1976. First, I'll talk about women in traditional China. How far should I go back? I think I need to go back 2,500 years ago to when Confucius lived. Confucius was China's greatest philosopher. He was the founder of the most successful moral and ethical system in human history, measured by the number of people in East Asia who have followed his ideas for the past two millenniums and who are still following them today. Confucianism over the millenniums, over the centuries, has evolved not into a religion, but more a ethical code of behavior. Just a few things about that. I know some of you probably have eaten Chinese food and opened the fortune cookies, and it says Confucius said you're going to have a good day today. Well, I don't think Confucius said necessarily those things, but Confucius did have a lot to say, and his sayings have been recorded by the Chinese. One of the perhaps most important or most famous things that he did say was, "Let the ruler be a ruler and the subject a subject. Let the father be a father and the son a son." Now, to understand what he was saying and why perhaps this is the most important saying in all of Chinese history, is that he lived during a very turbulent period in Chinese history, again, more than 2,000 years ago, when many of the people in China were rebelling against their local leaders, where you had sons disobeying their fathers, subjects rising up and assassinating their leaders. Confucius said, sat around with many people at the time and said, you know, what's the problem with the world today? Just like many of us maybe here in Holden are sitting around talking about how can we solve the problems of the world. So he and a group of people said, well, let's look back in our history. We have had a recorded history that remembers a time of peace. And so Confucius went back in history to come up with his idea that if everyone acted according to their place, if the subject acted like a subject and obeyed everything the emperor said, then we're not going to have any conflict. If the emperor acts like an emperor, that is, the emperor has to rule in a benevolent way. The emperor just can't hoard all the tax money and use it on his palaces. He must store grain in times of drought or in times of other terrible weather conditions. And same with the father-son relationship. And then, of course, that goes down to the relationship of the husband and wife. The wife must obey everything the husband does. The children must obey everything the father says. So if everyone knew their place in society, in this hierarchical system, then there will not be any confusion. And we see these roles still being an issue today in modern China. And when I talk about that and talk about the present birth control policy, we'll see how women are trying to live under modern edicts, but still living with many of these ancient traditions. Women's inferiority, according to Confucianism, was basic to the harmony of social order. According to a book written more than two millennia ago, it said, "A woman's duty is not to control or take charge. Instead, she must follow the three submissions. When she is young, she must submit to her parents. After her marriage, she must submit to her husband. When she is widowed, she must submit to her son. These are the rules of propriety." And this was in a book called Biographies of Admirable Women, compiled by, of course, an admirable man in 2,000 years ago. This way of women having to live under these three submissions was still the case in this century, two millenniums later. Before 1949, most marriages in China were arranged. And sometimes they were arranged when the child was born. Sometimes she would have to move into her spouse's family at a very young age. But otherwise, after she did get married, she would leave her village, perhaps never see her family again, and go to live with this person that she and his family that she does not meet until her marriage day. And once betrothed, even if they are not married, it was common during this period up until this century if the man were to die, even before they were married, she would remain a chaste widow for the rest of her life. Women were not called by their given names. They were called the wife of Wang, or the daughter of Deng, or the woman standing in front of the microwave, or just checking to see that you're awake. There weren't microwaves 2,000 years ago. You hear about extensive wife beating, and the Chinese have the longest recorded history and many, many books of proverbs. And one popular proverb was, women are like wheelbarrows. If not beaten for 3 days, they cannot be used. I'm not sure why you would beat your wheelbarrow, but the point is, this was one of their popular proverbs. Besides these arranged marriages, females were sometimes subject to child marriages, concubinage, infanticide, and the free market. Sometimes they were sold by the pound in the free market. Now, the situation was not all black. This would often occur when times were difficult, when there was a terrible drought, and a farmer, in order not to sell off his land, would sell off his children as a way to keep his land. But again, the situation, I'm painting a pretty gloomy situation. So what was, in life for Chinese women at this time? As women aged, their authority increased. There are numerous stories in Chinese history of mother-in-laws wielding their power. So as a woman, gets older in life, and if she produces a son, she will have more power in the household. Perhaps the most important right that women had in traditional China was the right to marry. It provided the only form of culturally legitimate security and power available to them. They would gain power by getting married and producing a son and establishing their own uterine family. Her chief function in life was to have babies. No matter what, a son must be born. It was very important to have a son, not only to take care of you in old age, because again, the tradition is that the woman would leave the home, and not just leave the home, but leave the village. If you go to China today, you will find many villages in China where it's only the Chen family lives here, or the Wang family in another village. So the Chen would move out to the Wang family. And so again, this is what the woman would do when she would marry. That means that if you had a daughter, that daughter would not be around in your old age to take care of you, to take care of the farm. So it was very important for Social Security that you produced a son. Also, it was very important for you to produce a son because only the son could take care of his ancestors. Only the son could take care of his great-great-great-great-grandparents. Only the son could carry out the ancestral rites. You've probably heard of ancestor worship in China. You can still see cases of that in Hong Kong and Taiwan, and now coming up again in China today, where it's not a religion, but it's a way of respecting their ancestors. So if a grandfather or grandmother dies, there will be a certain ritual that you do, and there will be times every day and certain times of the year where you will make offerings of fruit, of foods, where you will perform different rituals, and only the son can do that. If you do not have a son, excuse me, the Chinese believe that there will be no one taking care of the ancestors, and they will turn into hungry ghosts and come back and cause problems for the family. So that it was very important for someone to take care of these rituals to take care of not having hungry ghosts come back. And you hear of many cases, of course, there would be families who could not conceive, or families who could not have a son, would have 10 daughters or whatever, and still not conceive a son. Well, this is the cases where you have concubines, where you have someone coming in and producing a son for you, a second wife or a third wife to do that. Or if you were from a poor family and, for example, had many sons, you may sell your son or marry your son to a wealthier family, and that son will agree to take that family's name. That was very difficult. That was a loss of face to give up your family name, but there are many instances of that happening so that there will be someone to take care of your ancestors. One of the most extreme forms of male domination in traditional China was the act of foot binding. This was, you know, you could say male domination ensured in a very, very painful way. This started more than this started in the 1400s, and still today, when I go to China, I can still see women with tiny, tiny feet. They're called lily feet. And the goal was to get them less than 5 inches. And you would start 2 or 3 and start binding their feet so that they would grow, so that they would not grow. So this, again, was a way of making sure that your wife is not going to go too far. She's not going to go outside of the gate. She's not going to be able to hobble away too easily. Widespread foot binding prevailed for 5 centuries until the May 4th movement in 1919, when almost all reformers during this revolutionary period of Chinese history demanded an end to the subjugation of women in this way. Many people during this, I don't have time to go into the May 4th, 1919 movement, but this was a time when many people in China were thinking the only way for us to get rid of the foreign domination that has come into our country over the centuries is to modernize our country. And how can we modernize if we keep to the Confucian traditions? How can we call for a democracy and call for women suffrage when, you know, they can barely hobble to the voting booth, when they can't even choose who they're going to marry? So this is when many ideas were flowering, and many reformers and revolutionaries believed that the Confucian relationships really had to come to an end in order for China to modernize. One revolutionary who held this view was Mao Zedong, whose earliest writings, if you go back and read Mao's writings, some of his earliest writings dealt with the misery of women who were forced into marriages. And again, it was Mao who came up with the title for my talk, that women hold up half the sky and should be accorded equality with men. And when he and the Communist Red Army took over China in 1949, one of the first things he did was to improve the lot of women. So now I'm going to move in and talk to about the Maoist time from 1949 until he died in 1976. Again, I'm not holding up Mao on a pedestal, but he gained much popularity with a lot, you know, 50% of the population because of his writings on women. And, you know, we can go back and look at him as perhaps a good revolutionary, but then falls apart as a leader as we look back at other revolutionaries in world history and see maybe they have great ideas, but then power goes to their head later. But let's look a little bit at the Maoist period that leads us up into present-day China. So again, this is from 1949 until 1976. If you're looking at the, I forget, you have an outline too. So we're going to look at some of the clear facts, and then there's lots of murky facts that I'll touch upon. with regard to marriage. Again, one of the first things that Mao did when he took power in 1949, within 3 months, he enacted the marriage law of 1950. This was to get rid of prostitution, to get rid of child marriages, to get rid of the use of concubines, the sale of brides. Women could now have a choice in their marriage. They could now say, no, I'm not going to marry the person that my parents have set up for me to marry. They also could divorce their husbands. Before this, this was totally unheard of that a woman would be able to do this. With regard to education, Mao, back in 1949, when Mao took over China, probably 10 to 20% of the population was literate. So he's taking over a very poor country, devastated by the Japanese coming in World War II, devastated from the late 1830s, when the British won the Opium War and other foreign powers started carving up China. This is the period of Chinese history when you would see people with their wheelbarrows of money going to the market to buy a pound of carrots, when inflation had just skyrocketed by the end of the 40s, early 50s. So he's taking power at this time. But one of the important things that he believes in is universal education. Before this time, it would only be wealthy boys from wealthy families who would be able to get an education. And we see from that period on the gap between men and women, or girls and boys, there at the literacy, that gap being reduced. Today, almost all girls in China receive some education. With regard to politics, Mao had women in his Red Army. He called for women to become to engage in politics and be part of the political process and make decisions. It's interesting, though, to note when you go back and look over the period of Mao's rule that you find very, very few women in high positions. You find women in many of the low or local positions that Mao brought them in, but you find very few women at the higher levels of politics, of communist leadership in China. That's still the case in Deng Xiaoping's China today. With regard to economics, when Mao established his communes in the late 50s, we begin to see he called for men and women to work together on the communes. We see women being paid for the first time in their lives for all the work that they've been doing through the centuries, the farm work that they're doing. So for the first time, we're seeing them not working, but we're seeing them being paid for the work that they're doing. They did not get paid as much as the man doing the same thing next to them, but we see them getting paid. So again, Mao's writings don't necessarily coincide with the facts of what was happening at the time. Now, some of the murkier facts with regard to marriage. I mentioned that in 1950, one of the first things he enacted was the marriage law. Well, the good news was that during the first 3 years that this was enacted, supposedly hundreds of thousands of women who felt they were in terrible marriages, who, you know, didn't know their husband, who were forced into these marriages, applied for a divorce. The really awful news is that according to the government report, 70,000 to 80,000 women were killed or forced to commit suicide. Change was not going to be easy. The Confucian traditions of 2,000 years were not going to change overnight with an edict or with a marriage law, you know, put out by Mao. From then on, the party changed its focus on this. Instead of, you know, talking about divorces, they talked more about the freedom to say no before the marriage happened, and to be able to say that this was a matter between the families. Marriage, though, it's interesting to note that in China back then and still today, even though they have a population problem, it's still expected by the time you're in your 20s that you will marry. This is like the single accepted and only lifestyle in Chinese culture and China today. I was living in Beijing in my late 20s, and you know, all the people from I was working with, I was the only American working in a magazine office where probably more than 2,000 people work. They published this magazine in 20 different languages, and you know, constantly people were coming up to me and saying, "How old are you?" You know, I was 27. "Well, you know, I think it's time for you to go home now and get married, because if you weren't married by the time you were 30, then you must have some terrible disease. There must be something wrong with you, and your chances of getting married are nil. And, you know, in order to be a complete person in China, you have to be married. You have to have a child." So again, when we talk about the current policies, that's not even a issue in terms of lowering the population rate. Of course, everyone must get married in their 20s and produce children in order to keep the family line going. I have on your outline two egalitarian movements, the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution. Sometimes it's very easy to spend hours and hours and classes on these two movements. I'm going to just narrow it down to a paragraph now so that I can get through this talk in right under an hour. So Mao, these two movements, the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution, were what you could call egalitarian campaigns. In Maoist China, it was not uncommon to see women working on the railroads, to see women doing what would be non-traditional women's work, to see women up doing telephone lines, to see women in the coal mines. And you see for the first time operas that now feature women heroes, women who were in the Red Guard fighting for, or in the Red Army, fighting for liberation against Chiang Kai-shek, and who died right on the front line. So now they're starting to have Peking operas with women as the heroines. This is also the time in China where if you were walking down the street and noticed people walking in front of you, it would be hard to tell which gender was walking in front of you. This is a time when everyone was wearing the Maoist suits, the blue Mao jackets, the blue baggy pants. This was, you know, supposedly for women to hold up half the sky, to make them everyone equal, everyone wearing the same clothes. But many times, as we see, that Mao might have had some ideas that you could understand, we often see these ideas being carried out way to an extreme, that we have women during the Maoist time who were condemned verbally or maybe even physically if they wore makeup, or if they grew their hair longer than mine, or if they wore a red tie in their hair, or if they braided their hair with ribbons. They were, you know, they showing any type of individualistic clothing or makeup or making you stand out was pretty much a crime in Maoist China. So again, this is an example of things that, for example, happened during the Cultural Revolution to make the people of China all equal, but in fact, you know, was carried way to an extreme and hurt many, many people. There is a quote in a book that I highly recommend out of all the books that I listed on your sheet. It's called Wild Swans. And it's a book written by a Chinese woman in her late 30s today who goes back over the history of her grandmother and her mother and then herself. So it goes over Chinese history from the late 1800s until today. It's an incredible book. And a quote from this, which talks about the Maoist period, I'll just read in a second. This is about a friend of hers who was an older teenager who, during the Cultural Revolution, when Mao called for the Red Guards to go out across China, this was actually a very free period for youth to travel across China for free on trains in their baggy blue suits. But we also see some of the young people being more promiscuous than you would have seen in traditional China. So this is about a classmate of the writer who becomes pregnant. She was beaten by her father, followed by the accusing eyes of her neighbors, and enthusiastically gossiped about by her comrades. She hanged herself, leaving a note saying she was too ashamed to live. No one challenged this medieval concept of shame, which might have been a genuine target of the Cultural Revolution, but it was never one of Mao's concerns, and this was not one of the four olds that Mao called against to destroy. Well, Mao finally goes to see Marx. He finally dies in 1976, and the Cultural Revolution comes to an end. And China, again, is left just as it was left at the end of the Civil War in 1949, in economic, social, and political disarray. So while Mao put politics in command, we see the next leader, Deng Xiaoping, who takes power soon after Mao dies, and who still is the most powerful person at 91 years old today in China. He no longer holds a position. He's not president of the country or chairman of the party. But he, according to, you know, political scientists, is really still the most powerful person in China today. So now talking about the Deng Xiaoping era. So again, while Mao put politics in command, it was important to be read. Deng put economics in command. It was more important to modernize and make money. Perhaps Deng's most favorite quote is, "Who cares if the cat is black or white as long as he catches mice?" Now, this would have Mao rolling over in his mausoleum. The cat had to be red. The cat had to be politically correct. But what Deng Xiaoping is saying, that surprised the 1.2 billion population that had been going through living on communes with their baggy blue clothes, being politically correct, is that now Deng Xiaoping is saying, get rich quick. It doesn't matter how you do it. If it means now at this point in China, you see these young entrepreneurs who have 1,000 people working under them. And in many cases, there are many industries that are as capitalistic as the ones in our country or in Hong Kong or anyone any place in the world. But anyway, Deng Xiaoping takes power in a time of crisis of China. And he realizes, just like Mao did, that China needed to modernize. But Deng Xiaoping is saying, we need to modernize in terms of education, in terms of science and industry, in terms of agriculture, and it doesn't really matter how we go about doing it. If the end result is by the year 2000, we are a prosperous and wealthy country. And if some of you were in the talk today at lunch hour, we talked about how by the year 2000, China may be the number one economic powerhouse beating the United States. It's the fastest developing country in the world. Their GDP was up 10% this year. It's amazing what has happened during the Deng Xiaoping era. Deng quickly dismantled Mao's communes, basically giving the farmers a piece of their own land. He privatized industries. He opened the doors to China, opened the doors to McDonald's, to Hyatt Regencies, to the largest Kentucky Fried Chicken in China, to Nike, to Boeing, to Jeep, and even to Avon Ladies. You can find Avon Ladies in China. Now, when I was living in China in 1981, this was a few years after Mao died, but the main clothes were Mao's clothes. That's what I wore to work living there. That's what I rode on my bicycle with 5 million other people in Beijing. At that time there were no privately owned cars in Beijing. There were no joint ventures in Beijing. And if someone would have told me in 1981 that the world's largest Kentucky Fried Chicken would be right next to Mao's mausoleum in Tiananmen Square, I would have, you know, betted them thousands and thousands of dollars. This is not going to happen. But by the time I moved from Beijing to Hong Kong in 83, there was the first Holiday Inn in Beijing. There were the first joint ventures. Today, you can stay again at Sheratons, Hyatt Regencies, places all over urban China. It's changed quite drastically. And Chinese women are a part of this. They are walking through these doors that are opening up to them, wearing, you know, taking off their baggy clothes, wearing makeup, wearing mini skirts. And some of these women are even managing companies that have started up. Let's look at some of the facts again, both clear and murky. With regard to education today, the good news is that 70% of women in China today have some education. One out of three college graduates in China today are women. I mean, this is a phenomenal number. The bad news is that with this get-rich-quick mentality, where Mao has dismantled these huge communes where maybe 20,000 people lived on a commune. Now he's divided it up and everyone gets their own plot. Well, if you have this plot and you can produce as much as you can, it's a pretty tiny plot because we're talking about 7% of the world's arable land being in China with this huge population. But if you can, whatever you can produce on there after you've fulfilled your quota to the government, you can take it to the free market, you can do whatever you want. Or you could lease your land to someone else and start your own business. You see many women starting their own panda bear factories in their homes and trying to sell them abroad. Or you see people buying trucks that then can take these products and take them into urban areas and sell them at a higher price. So the bad news about education for girls in China today is that you see they're the first ones to be taken out of schools over the sons. The daughter would be taken out because of people thinking, well, they're just gonna get married and leave. And who knows when Deng Xiaoping's going to die, when this policy changes. What if we have to go back to a Maoist time period and we might as well get as rich as we can now, and if it means taking our daughter or sons out of school, let's do it to make more money right now. So we see women as entrepreneurs. For some, China's massive economic takeoff in the last couple of years means living a new glamorous and wealthy life for women. World headlines and magazines in China feature Chinese actresses who dine at the French restaurant Maxim's in Beijing for $90 a meal, where we see women investing in land deals and marketing their own line of expensive makeup. For other women in China, and certainly the majority, life today means less glamour, but perhaps more economic opportunity, more freedom, and more income. Today, on any of the streets of China, you'll see noodle shops going up that women have starting their own small private shop. Again, you'll see toy factories, and you'll see women starting taxi services or even smaller import-export companies. But for many today, there is less change and perhaps even more backbreaking work than there was before. Today, we see women holding up most of the farm. The statistics today show, with this new entrepreneur spirit and freedom to leave the place where you live, that many of the men in the household are leaving and going to the big cities to try to make it rich, and leaving the women down on the farm to tend to the farm duties. So in many cases today, we're seeing women perhaps working even harder in the agricultural areas. That means, you know, some good news and some bad news. While this is perhaps a much more exhausting life, they are able for the first time to purchase some luxuries, to purchase maybe a small washing machine, to purchase maybe a stove that has more than, you know, one place to cook on it, to purchase perhaps a tape deck, to purchase perhaps a bicycle for her children, to purchase a telephone, or a television, a sewing machine. Today, women have greater freedom to express themselves in the kinds of work that they would want and also in the way that they dress. While it was ideologically incorrect to comment on seeing a beautiful woman in Maoist times, today perhaps the pendulum has swung way too far in the other direction, where women are hired because of their beauty to lure people into land deals or to lure people in advertising. Today you go to China and see, you know, it looks like some places here in America, huge billboards of beautiful women selling different Chinese products. While making money and Western approaches to advertising has spurred new enterprises, it has also, again, used women as lures for business deals or to sell products. Unfortunately, there's even cases of women being used as a commodity in China, where they're actually being bought and sold. There are cases in the government paper that more than 10,000 women a year are abducted from their tiny village and taken and sold as someone's wife. So this is happening without them. No, you know, someone comes into a very, very poor village where these people may have a community telephone, or at least they would have a radio, or hear about this cousin that went down to Canton and is now making all this money. You know, they're hearing the same stories that I'm telling or that we're hearing in our press, and they're still eking out a living, making maybe $5 a month. You know, there are still people in China who, a family that may only want have one set of clothes that, you know, one of them wears to be able to go out to go to the market to buy something. I mean, there are still many, many poor people in China who are also hearing about these wealthier areas, mostly in the coastal areas or close to Hong Kong or close to the major cities. And someone comes to the village and says, we'll take 20 of the local girls to work at our factory 2,000 miles away in Canton, and they will be able to send all this money home, and you know, in 10 years they'll be able to come home again, when they're actually being taken and sold and maybe raped and then are pregnant and are shamed. They've lost face. They don't want their family to lose face and cannot return. So even the, you know, communist government papers are recording at least 10,000 cases of this a year. So again, with these economic freedom in China, we're seeing benefits to the women and also things that are, of course, the very opposite. One of the things that Mao has gone down in history for doing was wiping out prostitution, was wiping out venereal diseases. Not that we might agree of how he, you know, re-educated the prostitutes in Shanghai and different areas, but when I was there traveling around from 1979 up until the early 80s, I certainly did not see any cases of prostitution. Today, you go to any large hotel in China and, you know, I think you would recognize prostitutes. So that's, you know, if you can make, the average salary in China is about $20 to $40 a month. If you can make that much one night for your family, you know, it's happening there. Part of Deng Xiaoping's modernization program was his birth control program. More than a decade ago, we see Deng Xiaoping embarking on a one-child-per-family policy. And this has had many ramifications for women of China, as you can imagine. One thing, it has the positive, perhaps, it has freed women from the burden of multiple births and raising large families. But it has caused many, many problems. This new policy is at loggerheads with traditional China.